When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Greetings from the hill country of Central Texas. This is the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. We know that there are many podcasts competing for your time and attention. We hope to bring you the content and guests to be your go-to podcast for the study of war, warfare, and strategy. Thank you for listening, and we hope that you find this episode both entertaining and informative. Today's episode is a rerun of a very popular episode from Season 1. This episode has been remastered for sound quality, but not edited for content from its original airing during Season 1. Enjoy.
On today's episode, we're talking with Professor Christopher Tuck. Chris is a professor of strategic studies at King's College London, where he began teaching in 1997. Prior to that, Chris was a senior lecturer at the UK Department of Defense and International Affairs at the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst. And then prior to that, he was a research intern at Safer World, a foreign policy lobbying group. His research interests focus on strategy as it relates to conflict termination, land warfare, and in particular, the future of land warfare and the counterinsurgency operations, particularly British's operations in Borneo between 1963 and 1966. However, I had Chris on the show to discuss maneuver warfare, particularly and land warfare in general. Considering all the conversations going on regarding maneuver warfare today, especially as it pertains to what we're seeing out of Ukraine and what we're seeing in Gaza as it relates to Israel's operations, I figured it was an ideal time to have him on to talk to us about maneuver. And Christopher's approach is terrific because it is one of the most balanced and logical analyses I've seen or heard on the subject. So without further ado, this is Christopher Tuck from King's College London. All right, so good morning. Today we have Professor Chris Tuck from King's College London on the podcast. We're going to talk about, enough war and warfare. And with that, Chris, I'd just like to thank you for coming on this morning.
Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. So why did I have Chris come on? So Chris has written some terrific stuff here, and if you're not aware, I really suggest you go out and get it. A couple months ago, I was telling Chris before we got going, I'd picked up Understanding Land Warfare, his book that was published in, 2015 through Routledge, and it's absolutely phenomenal book. It takes the very complex idea of land warfare and, like the title says, makes it easy to understand, right? And so it condenses down a lot of complex ideas associated with land warfare. And I think it's terrific. I've recommended it to many people, and I'm not here plugging the book. I just want to ask Chris, how did you tackle such a challenging topic so well?
Thanks, Amos. So what was interesting to me, I guess, and which sort of provided the motivation to write the book was, so I work at the UK Defence Academy.
Okay.
So I'm teaching mid-rank officers. And what was interesting, because this is a joint environment, mm-hmm. we're teaching Army officers, but we're also teaching Air Force, Navy officers as well. What was interesting was that I couldn't really find a book which would, well, really do two things. First, if you didn't know anything about land warfare, if you were from one of the other domains and you wanted to know what makes land warfare tick, you know, some of its inherent attributes, the nature of what it is to fight on land, then it would be useful to have something that would help for that audience. Yeah. So starting at the literally at the ground up, and then working through some of the more complex issues. If you're fighting on land, what is difficult about it? What helps define its character? So that was one issue. And the other issue was looking for something that would help bring together theory and practice. So, you know, military practitioners have their doctrine, but that doctrine doesn't always, I think, effectively or sometimes even accurately talk about some of the wider debates. I think it can simplify or misinterpret some of the issues. And then for an audience that wasn't in the military, from the other side of the fence, I suppose, it was about finding something that would help pass military doctrine for them, why militaries think in the way that they do, what shapes their approaches, what are the sorts of key issues, key ideas. So I was looking for something that would cover that sort of ground, and I couldn't find it, so yeah. I went and I wrote it.
Yeah, that's perfect. Based off that, what is this is a side question here. What is it that the joint folks seem to have the hardest time understanding about land warfare that you've seen?
Well, I mean, the key issue, I think, is one that crosses all of the domains. And it's worth noting that alongside understanding land warfare, there are others who've written understanding naval warfare, understanding air warfare, and so on. The biggest problem, I think, is the extent to which in individual domains there's a tendency to overstate the effectiveness or capabilities of one's own domain, of one's own service, and not to focus sufficiently on some of the challenges and actually, you know, some of the weaknesses. And also allied to that, there's a tendency, I think, to overstate some of the problems with using the other domains as instruments of power, and also not understanding from that perspective their strengths. So in a joint environment, you need officers that have an accurate, realistic appreciation of the strengths and weaknesses of all of the domains, because these days, whether it's joint warfare, multi-domain approaches, of course, is the latest label for thinking about contemporary and future war. If you're going to do multi-domain operations, joint operations effectively, you need officers who understand accurately what military instruments can and can't do across all of the domains. So that was, I think, my motivation for writing the book, and at least for the land domain, was to give a lay audience some understanding of how the military think, and the military audience some understanding of the academic debates, which often, if they don't directly challenge military doctrine, and sometimes they do, often complicate it.
Something interesting that you pointed out too is when you were just explaining that is overstating the importance of one's own domain versus another. And an interesting thing that you raise in the book that I think is really, really important though, is that understanding land warfare, you talk about land forces and one of their key elements is their persistence. How is that important as it relates to a joint fight? What do land forces do as it relates to persistence that kind of completes the circle, completes the approach to war fighting that other services can't accomplish.
So, Amos, that is it's control. It's being able to occupy ground and stay there. So on the one hand, that generates basic advantages for land power that other domains don't have. So using air power, using remote firepower, you can deny ground for a period of time to an adversary. You can just make it too dangerous for them to stay. You can force them to vacate ground for a period of time. But most of the really important objectives that you would want to achieve using military power sooner or later require you to occupy ground and stay there. So that's partly, of course, in terms of conventional military operations, and you see that in Ukraine. Yep. Because land is critical to warfare. It has political significance, it has economic significance, it has tactical operational significance, so you need to be able to take it. But it's also significant for other reasons. You know, human beings live on land, and they don't live on the sea, and they don't live in the air.
Yeah.
So if you want to control people, if you want to interact with people and generate influence with people, you have to be able to exercise a persistent presence on the ground. And so, that makes land power critically important right across the spectrum of conflict. So counterinsurgency operations are based upon controlling populations, which means you have to control ground. Stability operations, high intensity war fighting. So that is a critical advantage. And that's one of the things which makes land forces, in a sense, it's a point made. It's a point made by other writers, first amongst equals.
Yeah.
All other things being equal, land forces are likely to be able to give you the potential for the most decisive outcomes, in theory. But it's also important to understand that carries with it a lot of disadvantages or challenges and a lot of problems, which also explain why often you don't use land forces and other tools would be better. So issues to do with the presence of land forces are often associated with larger political problems, the political footprint that comes from questions about deploying your troops, for example, in someone else's country, the political problems that can come from deploying your own troops in your own country. If you look at the British experience with deploying the British Army in Northern Ireland, the sorts of alienation that can come from doing that. It's Colin Gray's point about the obsolescing welcome that happens when you deploy troops amongst civilians. So I mean, it comes back to the point that I was making previously, which is that you need to understand the potential strengths and weaknesses of land forces in order that you can make the right choice about when to use them, when not to use them, how to use them best. And there will be many occasions in which you don't want your land forces used, or you want the land forces used only in carefully circumscribed ways. It might indeed be that you want maritime forces instead, or you want to use air power. But what's important is that everyone understands very clearly and accurately strengths and weaknesses and how you can use the different domains effectively to cover one another's weaknesses, and also using them together to create synergies.
Completely agree, and I think it's also interesting if you go back to Clausewitz and what he wrote about centers of gravity. I'm not a huge centers of gravity fan. I think in many cases that idea is no longer useful. However, he wrote that centers of gravity were generally one of three things: an army, the capital, an adversary's capital, or an ally, right? And so it's when you look at that, granted there was not really a lot of air power going on during the Napoleonic Wars, nor was there cyber operations. But, those things, I think, that idea that he identified then remains, you know, is transcendent towards today. And it, I think it gets to that point that, you know, the persistence that land forces provide is really one of their most valuable attributes. And you mentioned something too, when we were talking about, when you were talking about that and the importance of land forces and their persistence and how that factors into to modern warfare. And it was, you mentioned long range fires and you mentioned strike and standoff warfare. I think that there, it seems, and maybe I'm just overly pessimistic, but it seems as though we're trying to replace the importance of land forces persistence with standoff capability, and we've forgotten that the persistence is where land forces are most useful, or maybe not most useful, but extremely useful, and they bridge the gap between all the other stuff that joint forces can do versus what land forces can do. And so it seems to me that perhaps, at least theoretically, we're trending towards this idea that warfare is becoming a targeting process mentality, as opposed to a like, let's go fight a land campaign, or let's go fight a joint campaign, not necessarily a land campaign, but a joint campaign to accomplish military and political objectives. Do you see something similar in either the writing or your day job, or just generally watching the trends in international relations?
I do, Amos. It's a slightly worrying trend, though not not an unusual one. I think that classically, when I was going to say military organisations, but it's not specific to military organisations. I think it's something about Western culture. When we try and interpret change, what we have a tendency to do, I think, is to focus on technology. And to focus on novelty and to spend our time looking for and trying to identify revolutionary change. And we seem always, constantly, to be in periods of technologically generated military revolution caused by, you know, new capabilities that have emerged. And I think that then speaks to the observation that you've made, because I think that for many, many commentators and in terms of, I think, some of the new concepts that seem to have a lot of traction in terms of, you know, from a British perspective, things like multi-domain integration and so on, there is a significant focus on new technology and the effect that that is having on things like increasing the transparency and lethality of battlefields, increasing the range at which conflicts will take place, as speeding up the tempo of war, leading, you know, hyperactive battlefields, that sort of thing. And I think this is problematic because what it does is it focuses us on change and not continuity. And I think that when you look at the past, what you see are many incidences where the reality of war as it has actually occurred is the amalgam or the outcome of some combination of both change and continuity.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's interesting when you look at the war in Ukraine and then debates now on the extent to which you can use Ukraine to extrapolate what the future of land warfare will look like. Because on the one hand, it is absolutely the case that long-range precision fire is an important capability.
Yep.
And the ability to call on that quickly and accurately is really important. I mean, that has been one of the lessons, certainly, that's been reinforced by the war in Ukraine. It's the extent to which having the capability to bring in longer range fires than your adversary and to bring those in quickly onto key nodes, so logistics dumps, headquarters, your opponent's long range fire capabilities. These things are important. But when you look at how the war is actually being fought on the ground, it is also clear that those sorts of capabilities are still an auxiliary element to the key facets of land combat at a tactical operational level. So when you look at the progress that is being made in the fighting at the moment, what you see, in fact, is in many respects, a restatement of the importance of traditional infantry infiltration tactics that were developed during the First World War. So the latest Ukrainian techniques, for example, for trying to make progress against Russian defences actually involve the devolved use of small groups of infantry infiltrating forward. So you want your long-range fire capabilities to support them. And it is also the case that long-range fires are killing or injuring most of those that are being killed or injured.
Yep.
I've seen figures between 80 and 90% of casualties are coming from long-range fires, but that's not new either. In the Second World War, it was over 70%. So I think that the problem that we have at the moment is that we are repeating the mistake that we have made many times in the past in focusing on novelty and not thinking enough about how the new will interact with the old to produce a changing character of war. I mean, ultimately, in Ukraine, you need to be both innovative and adaptive, but you also need to be competent in the basics of combined arms warfare.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. I think the first thing that once you put an army in the field, whoever you happens to be, once you put an army in the field, the first rule of warfare is don't die, right? And so regardless of how high-tech your military may be, the first rule of the war is don't die. And so you're going to quickly devolve or evolve, whichever way you want to look at it, to operate in a way that allows you to accomplish your objectives, but not die doing so, or not die as quickly as you could if you were just going, hey, diddle diddle, right up the middle, and trying to just move out and accomplish those objectives. And I think that's a good point that we need to keep in mind when we think about what you said, the continuities interacting with the novelty. Like, the first rule of war is don't die. And so all these cool things that we're putting on the battlefield, like, you know, transparent battlefield. Well, if there's armies still in the field, they're probably just going to go, you know, like we see, underground or at least in some sort of trench with overhead cover, and then only come out when needed to move forward and do things. And so I very much appreciate that perspective. I also think that your point on Ukraine is a good one too, because I think a lot of folks use it as it's a convenient tool for whatever your narrative may be about warfare and the future of warfare. And you can always go find something to justify it. You know, some people are like, you know, this, you know, large scale conventional land warfare is back. Some people are like, well, it's only back because Russia and Ukraine actually aren't very good militaries. I saw that one recently. And, you know, so it's just this, it's, if you want to justify anything, you can find it in that conflict. And I think the closing point before I maneuver on to my next question, that's a cheeky segue there, is that there's really no game-changing technology. There's always this arc of challenge and response, and the folks with the challenge will always be a step ahead of the responder. And you know, so like when something new is introduced, there's going to be that period where
many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
they're going to get this asymmetric advantage for a short period of time, but eventually the response will catch up with that. And so, if you cut my little joke there, we're going to talk about maneuver now. This will be the last little bit of what we talk about here today. And so, going back to your book, Understanding Land Warfare, but then also you had a great chapter in a new book that just came out through Oxford University Press called Advanced Land Warfare Tactics and Operations. I think that your description of maneuver and how it interacts with attrition is one of the most level-headed and reasoned understandings out there. And I think I'm a little biased because I'm in the camp that you can't do it all the time everywhere, and that it's based off components, so the things that you have or don't have. It's based off the conditions, right? So if you're not in an environment that's suitable for maneuver, you're not going to be able to do maneuver as much as you want to say we do maneuver, right? And so, like, I work in a big city in Central Texas, and when I look out the window from the building that I work in, I say, how do you do maneuver in that? You can't, because it's just so big and it's so dense that the conditions aren't present for maneuver, at least at the big scale. Maybe at the small, like squad level scale, but that's you can justify that all the time in almost any environment. And so I say all that to say, tell me about your thoughts on maneuver. I think it's, how did you come to such reasoned, level-headed approach to this? Because it's a very hot-button topic today.
I came to the assessment of that, a kind of a more balanced approach towards this relationship between attrition and maneuver, simply because I became concerned about the extent to which maneuverism has become elevated almost to the status of a religion in military organizations, which I think is both dangerous and unfair for military officers. Because in a sense, as I indicate in the chapter, there is a sense in which maneuverism as a philosophy, a maneuverist approach, essentially is so nebulous that it becomes anything that works. And it's applied retrospectively. Usually it's used to explain why losers lost,
that's right,
why the winners won. If you were successful, you're a maneuverist. You've employed maneuverism, a maneuverist approach. And if you failed, it's because you weren't maneuverist.
Yeah, you're just a dumb attritionist.
Yeah. And I think that is dangerous. And I think, as I say, it is unfair because it is expecting, or seems to expect, that in every situation, any quality officer should be able to come up with an innovative approach which will guarantee success quickly and with minimal losses. And it's ahistorical.
Yeah.
So if you think about attrition as a wearing down process, and if you think about maneuverism as something which is more system focused, it's focused on tempo, it's focused on pitting your strengths against your opponent's weaknesses, and it's focused on attacking sort of key nodes and intangibles. So you collapse the enemy's system by attacking those things that matter most to them. And so you don't have to work your way through their military capability. So it should be quicker, it should be more decisive, it should be lower cost. But actually, I think that when you look at how we have fought in the past, you can see that there is this synergistic relationship between attrition and maneuver. And I think, that is often recognized, but I don't think it's often recognized just how important that attritional component is, because often that relationship between attrition and maneuver is characterized in terms of, well, the purpose of maneuver is attrition. And if you employ maneuver correctly, you will ensure that attrition is employed disproportionately against the adversary and not against you. But, when you look at the past, you can see many circumstances in which there is no maneuverist key that will unlock a difficult situation. Essentially, you are locked into a process of attrition, not just for hours or days, but for weeks or months and maybe years. before you can start to be able to apply what we might think as being classic maneuver warfare. And that is because ultimately the context may dictate that there is no easy way of thinking about clever solutions to the problems that you face. So if you take the Normandy campaign as an example, I mean, that is a successful campaign. It achieves its objectives on time. You know, you land on the 6th of June. The aim is to get to Paris in 90 days, and they do it. But it is a very, very different kind of campaign from the one that's expected. You spend about 7 weeks, it's nearly 2 months, locked into grinding attrition against the German army. Difficult, high intensity, high casualty attritional warfare. And that's not because Allied officers are stupid. It's not because they're not trying to think creatively. And there is plenty of innovation, particularly at a tactical level.
Yep.
But I think the point to make is that there are many circumstances, particularly when you're up against an adversary who is competent, where you simply cannot win quickly. And I think that's interesting because, I mean, you mentioned about Ukraine and, you know, the Ukrainians and Russians might be just, you know, they're not good militaries. But we see in Ukraine exactly this issue of what happens if you are fighting against an adversary whose quality of force employment is not significantly worse than yours. Mm-hmm. This is one of the problems, for example, going back to the Gulf War and looking at that as an example of the success of maneuver warfare. I think that it is equally plausible that all the Gulf War tells you is that where that gap in quality of force employment, this is Stephen Biddle's point in his excellent book of Military Power, where that quality of force employment is significantly different, more or less any approach will work. Frontal assault will break your adversary very quickly. And indeed, in those circumstances, the quicker and larger your frontal assault, perhaps, the quicker you will win. So there is a basic problem, I think, with that assumption that if you're in attrition, you're an idiot, you've failed. There is a lot that you need to do in what can be the inevitable attritional phases of a campaign, a lot you need to do to win, and you need to think creatively about how you do attrition. And that is a problem because I think that, well, for two reasons. One is that culturally, Western militaries are uncomfortable with attrition. You don't get promoted by saying, "This is a plan in which I intend to grind my way through the enemy." You don't get promoted for saying that. So culturally, as a military, skill is about rapidity, decisiveness, and low cost. But there's also an issue of practicality. I think Western militaries are predisposed towards wanting to elevate maneuver to the forefront of their concepts for fighting, because Western militaries cannot fight attritionally anymore. And you made the point about needing to survive to be able to innovate. And I think one of the problems that we have, I mean, certainly, for example, the British Army does not have the capability to fight a Ukraine-style war with the attrition it will take, because it will have very quickly indeed a devastating effect on the capabilities of the forces. Even if we could provide more manpower, it won't be as well trained as the army that goes to war. Actually, one of the lessons from the past, First World War, Second World War, is that the army you eventually win with probably isn't the army you started with.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And part of that is it's about attrition and the wearing down that happens.
Yeah, that. And in many cases, the army you win with is that army of recruits that is just pulled to the front and hastily trained and, you know, given a rifle and said, "Ready, set, go." And that really, really, really well-trained army that you started with is long gone. And there may be a few folks still around, but not a lot.
No. Well, I mean, it's a good way of getting promoted if you can survive.
That's right.
I think that for me is the worrying thing, that we're betting the farm on maneuverism. When we should also be asking the question, if we have to fight attritionally, because history suggests we will have to.
Clearly.
How can we do that?
Yeah, and that's where I think when we look at Western military doctrine as well, across, you know, both sides of the proverbial pond, there's a significant lack of, so doctrine seems to be written from the perspective of, this is what I want to do, right? And like, generally speaking, like, that's cool, but it doesn't necessarily matter what you want to do. Because again, going back to what we're discussing, you know, capability, what do you have? Can you do it physically? Does the terrain allow you to do it? You're talking about the Normandy campaign, you know, Bocage country made maneuver very challenging because the terrain said no, you know, and then the enemy said no on top of the terrain, right? Those two things intertwined said, you're just going to have to slug your way through this thing until you get to a point where you can then do the big exploitation move, right? And so that's a major problem with Western military doctrine today, is it's so focused on preference and not focused on reality, to your point. You know, like, we're developing and training folks that don't understand the situation, the environments that they may find, that they will likely find themselves, not may, probably will find themselves in, at least to a point. And I think Alexander Svechin, an early 20th century Russian strategist and Russian military officer, in his book Strategy, he talks about the purposeful use of attrition, and it very much outlined or aligns with what you were saying, and how, you know, sometimes you just have, you know, if your main effort's over here, sometimes you have an attritional element to the you know, aligned with that, that's just there to grind down the opponent and suck down resources from the opponent. You know, I think that's a big part of what we forget, is we forget that, like, math matters and resource matters, and at the end of the day, like, if you're trying to get something, again, going back to Clausewitz, which is, you know, definition of a center of gravity, the army, capital, or ally, to focus on that, you need to pull resources away from somewhere else, right? It's almost attritional by not doing attrition in other places, as opposed to focusing everything in one spot. And so it's just an interesting problem, I think, with how we view the world today, Western militaries view the world today, as it relates to that.
I think you know, there's a tendency to think that you only do operational art when you're doing maneuver.
Yeah, that's right.
And there is skillful operational art involved in attritional approaches.
Oh, absolutely. And that gets to the last point on maneuver before we move on. I'll have one more question on maneuver, but the last point that I'm going to make here real quick is that the systems, so I'm a huge systems thinking person, and I think that systems thinking is how you have to approach warfare, and you have to think of yourself, but think of your adversary as a large open system that interacts with the environment, learns, adapts, and does all those things that systems theory talks about. And I think, you know, going back to like the early 90s, the Gulf War period, you had John Warden, you know, the Five Rings Theory. He talked about the adversary as a system, but I think in many cases he misunderstood or misapplied that systems theory thing. And so, you know, we talk about maneuver being a systems thinking oriented approach, but I think really attrition, in my opinion, is just as much a systems thinking approach as maneuver might be, because you're just going about it differently. And I would argue you're going about it more practically, because with maneuver, you're going after theoretical things, right? Theoretically inducing cognitive collapse, right? And paralysis. Whereas with attrition, you're just trying to like physically break the system through attacking certain parts of it. And so I think it's important to understand for folks that are trying to understand how those two things interact. They are both systems-oriented thinking. And it was I thought it was good too. I don't know if I can find it real quick. But you mentioned in here when you're talking about Soviet operational art. Yeah, here it is. This is great. I'm talking about Tukhachevsky, and I'm going to quote from your book here. Tukhachevsky argued that the aim of an operation was not the destruction of some hypothetical abstract nervous system of the army, but destruction of the real organism. And I think that that's brilliant when we think about the relationship between systems thinking, attrition, and maneuver, you know, because it's, you can go after the abstract, or you can go after what you know is real. And, you know, it may sound awful going after what's real, you know, we're going to just go try and attack this, you know, whatever element this thing is, and destroy it. versus like do some big oop de oop and try and make them go, oh gosh, we give up, you know, because you got behind us. And I know I'm oversimplifying, but
No. I think it's an important point because again, if you look at the Normandy campaign, part of that attritional approach is breaking in a fundamental way your opponent's concept of how they want to fight. You keep pushing along the front line, make it impossible for the Germans to take their panzer division, their maneuver elements out of the line. They cannot form the counter-attacking groups that they would need to engage in and in the sort of fight that they want to engage in. So there is a way in which you can dominate the enemy and prevent them from fighting in the way that they want to fight through attritional approaches. So I think, as I said, there is skill in operational art involved in attrition. We need to give that more credence.
All right. So last question on maneuver. What is the future of maneuver? You talk about it in Advanced Land Warfare. You got a chapter on it. Another sound discussion on the interaction of maneuver and attrition. But looking at the future, tell me what you think the future of maneuver warfare is.
So I'm worried, given what I've said and bearing that in mind. I mean, it seems to me that the logic of multi-domain approaches to warfare is essentially a kind of it's an extension of the maneuverist thinking. That idea that so the multi-domain approach is essentially a net-centric approach to thinking about warfare. Mm-hmm. And I think once again, as we've done many times in history, there is a view that technology is producing a military revolution. That military revolution is information-based. And that victory in future war will come from information superiority. And you can leverage that through creating a system of systems, a multi-domain approach. You break down the vertical compartmentalization that we impose on war. You break down the differences between the levels of war. You break down the horizontal compartmentalization by breaking down the differences between the domains. It means that you can do hypermaneuverism with your information superiority. You will be able to map your opponent's military system in exquisite detail and attack all of those key nodes very, very quickly, very accurately, and essentially collapse their system very quickly indeed. So this net-centric approach based on an information-based military revolution should finally allow maneuverism to become absolutely the dominant form of war in the future. And I find that it's contestable, and I think it's for reasons which I think are self-evident given our previous discussion, a very dangerous thing. Yeah. I think that to pick up the theme that you mentioned, Amos, I think that we are building an idea of the orientating our land forces towards an idea of a war that we would like to fight, not necessarily the war that we will get. I mean, it's a point made by the strategist Colin Gray. Most wars are a race between belligerents to correct the mistaken assumptions they began with. And the problem with thinking of assuming that information superiority, faster kill chains, more extensive digital architectures to network things together, assuming that those will increase decisively our military effectiveness versus likely adversaries in the future, is very dangerous given what we know about the nature and character of warfare. So, for example, war is adversarial. If networks are going to become so important to the way in which we try and fight, self-evidently, adversaries are going to target those networks. So in some respects, the actual character of the war we get in the future might be what's left when our current theories have failed and we are then trying to work with the remnants of those in combination with those sorts of traditional verities like combined arms warfare that have worked in the past and that I think will be important in the future. So our current view of the future, I think, is highly maneuverist, and it is based on information superiority and net-centric warfare. And I think there are reasons why that approach has been problematic in the past, and I think that we will see that we will struggle to implement them in the future. So I would see the future being, in a sense, what we're seeing in Ukraine, which is that blend of aspects of change, aspects of continuity in the particular context in which you're fighting.
Is there a hot take out there right now in military thinking or in just how people are viewing armed conflict today that you think is absolutely incorrect or just completely off the mark?
Well, I think it builds on what I've just said. When you survey contemporary military thinking, and it's not even just Western military thinking, if you look at Russian ideas relating to reconnaissance strike complexes, Chinese ideas of intelligentized warfare, two things I think form at the moment a matter of consensus. One is that the future is information superiority. It's networks and AI. And second, we are still thinking, as we have tended to do in the past, about the changing character of warfare as if there will only be one. And I think that, you know, there are significant warnings from the past about focusing too much on technology and information as the route of success, and also on the idea that there's only one possible future, because there's probably as many future characters of land warfare as there will be land wars.
Thank you for listening to the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. We know that there are a lot of other podcasts out there competing for your time, and we appreciate you sharing your time with us. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you would share this on social media. We would also appreciate it if you would provide us a rating on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. These ratings help new listeners find the podcast. Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.